This is Peter Aylward at the Kennedy Space Center for the Space Show on Southern FM, and I'm joined by astronaut Bjarni Tryggvason from the Canadian Space Agency. Welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, good to be here. Good to chat with you.
You're from Canada, and yep. You're involved with the Space Shuttle program. You've flown on one mission yourself
in 1997.
Okay, that was STS...
85.
Okay. Could you tell me what your involvement on that mission was?
Well, that mission was primarily a science mission. It was we flew the shuttle up to an inclination of 57.5 degrees inclination, focused on science, both looking back at the Earth with various sensors, looking out at the sun with other sensors, looking at other stars and Hale-Bopp comet, and then a number of free-fall experiments we had inside the shuttle. My own involvement was mainly working on the science, and in fact I was working with science mounted on this vibration isolation system that I've actually developed for use in the space, manned spacecraft. And we were looking at the behavior of fluids in the free-fall environment of space, and looking at the effect of the shuttle vibrations on that behavior. So that was my main involvement.
Okay. Did that any of those results or experiments have input into the design of the International Space Station, or was that?
Well, that whole system was actually designed primarily to be used on the space station, and the flights we did with this back in 96 to 98 on the Russian space stations, and the ones on my flight were really to learn how best to do that for the space station. And so there is a system actually going to the space station that does similar things, and is built into the European Fluid Science Lab, and that's going to go up to the space station on the Columbus module. So it's really all leading up to how do we improve the quality of the science and experiments that we do on the space station. And these were the first flights and the first tests to really hone in on how to do that better on the space station.
Right. Could you tell me a little bit how the Canadian Space Agency works with NASA, and I guess how does a Canadian astronaut get assigned to a particular flight? Is it primarily to run a Canadian-developed experiment, or...?
Well, the original involvement started with when the U.S. was developing the space shuttle, and Canada, through our National Research Council, developed a robotic arm for the space shuttle. And subsequently, these robotic arms are added basically to all the space shuttles, and they fly on pretty well all the missions. So it's really because we contributed that to the space shuttle program that NASA gave us the opportunity to fly Canadian astronauts on the space shuttle. And then the International Space Station program is a partnership between the U.S., Canada, the European Space Agency, Japan, and then Russia became a partner of that in 1992. And because each of these partners are building part of the space station, then that basically entitles you to use the space station both for the science you might do and also for the astronaut flights that you would actually have on the space station. So it's through that kind of partnership that Canada really is part of the whole program. And along the way, that also led to us getting additional flights on the space shuttle for Canadian astronauts. The flights that we're going on now are primarily to do with just the general things involved in assembling the space station. They're not necessarily tying Canadian activity to Canadian astronauts, with the exception of when we took the robotic arm to the space station, then a Canadian astronaut was involved in that. And that's part of these agreements that when the Columbus module goes up, there will be a European astronaut. When the Japanese module goes up, there will be a Japanese astronaut. But most of the flights, other than that, all the astronauts are working on just the general things that are required to assemble and operate the space station.
Right. So you're saying your fluid isolation experiment, was it?
Well, the system I developed is called the microgravity vibration isolation mount.
Okay.
We flew it on the Russian space station, then on the space shuttle, and then there's a variant going on the International Space Station. And it is used to support experiments in fluid science. And they could be experiments where you're growing protein crystals out of a fluid. You could be doing experiments where you're looking at the behavior of metals in space, developing different alloys, developing metal crystals in space where you can grow these things bigger. So there's a whole range of things you can actually use the fluids for investigating things in space, in addition to what you would do on the ground to sort of complement to what you would do on the ground.
The Canadian Space Agency and the private contractors in Canada have been very successful with the robot arm, as you mentioned, both on the shuttle and also on the ISS, but they also had quite a significant involvement in the return to flight effort. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, in fact, part of it came from the robotic arm development, because we developed through the McDonnell Detweiler in Canada another boom that now sits on the right-hand side of the shuttle, and it allows you to look underneath the space shuttle and look at the tile. It has a more reach than the standard shuttle arm. And then on the end of that boom is a vision system that was developed by NEPTEC. And in fact, that vision system came out of work that myself and Steve McLean were involved in back in 1986 to 92 on Steve's first flight. That's the space vision system. And that is used on the space shuttle, and the variant that is used on the space station to be the robotic eyes for the system. And NEPTEC was a company that actually built the space vision system for us. And they went on to develop a laser scanner that is actually used to now inspect the tiles on the shuttle after a launch to make sure that there's no issues with the tiles that would be a threat on your return.
Right. So do you have a flight assignment coming up? Is that something that's...
No, I left Houston about 3 or 4 years ago to pay more attention to my own family as my kids are going to university. And while I'm still in the program and still working on some of the science side of things, I'm probably not going to be flying again. I'll work on the science side, and certainly interested in following through on the science work that I've been doing, but will not probably be active in flying again.
Sure. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Canadian Space Agency? The reason I'm asking is that Australia and Canada are very much similar in population and in geographic spread,
yeah.
And Canada's been extremely successful in space area, and unfortunately Australia has not had a lot of activity. Could you tell me a little bit about some of the things? I know you're obviously involved in the manned side of things, mm-hmm. but I guess it extends a lot more than that as well.
Yeah, you know, if you take a sort of a big picture look at what's the purpose of the space program in general, there's a few things that it does that would be hard to replicate also. The main thing is that it's very difficult to design and build hardware and have it work successfully in space. So it's a very, very severe driver on quality of engineering, the type of engineering you do, and it's a good driver on the science you do as well. And it is that driver that then feeds back into a lot of other things that we tend to take for granted. And it is to have our industries and our universities involved in those kind of real drivers in technology and science development that the space program fits into. The next part of the space program is Earth observation. You know, the world has major problems that we have to somehow understand and wrestle with in terms of the environmental issues, the effect that we're having on the planet, overuse of resources. The only real way to monitor these is from space, ultimately through Earth sensing satellites. So Canada does a lot in that. The U.S. does a tremendous amount in that. A lot of countries, China, India, Europe, Russia, are doing a lot in that. And even Australia, I think, should be doing things in there, because we're all going to be impacted by the effects that these things have. So the space part is really exciting. The effects really filter into a lot of other things. And that's really the reason that Canada's involved. That's the reason that the U.S. is involved. That's why Europe and these other countries are involved in these kind of programs, because they are very, very severe drivers in their science and technology.
And I guess it also helps to foster domestic industrial progress and research and developing of your own industries in Canada?
Absolutely. We focus on the robotics. Because robotics is used in a lot of other areas, and we hope that there's going to be a trickle down of the demanding quality of the robotics and the complete analysis of all that trickles down into other applications. Like, you know, one that MDA is in fact involved in, and as are some other people at universities, is robotics used in medicine. And you can do a lot of work where you have force reflection and sort of scaling of the movement of the surgeon's hands compared to what happens with a robot actually doing the actual work on the person's body. There's a lot of spin-off in there, and it is that trickle down that is really an important payback on the whole program.
Yes, sure. So you've flown in space. Would you like to share with the listeners briefly, if you've got a few moments, that experience?
It's an incredible adventure. I mean, You know, after flying a space, I did a lot of work on the shuttle flying simulators where you go through the whole activity again. And you know, this space shuttle is just one amazing, amazing vehicle. The fact that it has problems once in a while is not because of the quality; it's because of the complexity of the system. It's very hard to make these happen. But you know, the launch is just an incredible experience. You jump off the launch pad and in 40 seconds going almost straight up, you've broken the speed of sound. In 2 minutes, you're going 3,500 miles an hour. It takes 8.5 minutes to get into space, and you're doing 17,500 miles an hour. And it's hard to comprehend what that kind of speed is. And I think the best way I can describe it is you're going 8 times faster than a high-power rifle bullet. And you've gone from no speed to that kind of speed in 8.5 minutes. So it's an incredible experience. I mean, you get this amazing view of the Earth. I had a great view of Australia on the last day of my mission. It's just an amazing experience. And then the work you're doing, you do a lot of training to get ready for it because you don't want to mess things up there. And so you're doing things that you're very familiar with because you've done them so many times. And in that sense, it feels like a normal working day. But then you're floating. And then you can see the Earth below you. And so it's like you're in a dream. So you're like in a normal working day and dreamland at the same time.
How did you sleep on orbit? Was that kind of strange? Did you wake up thinking you were floating in space?
Well, I was.
Yeah, exactly.
Sleeping... You just float around inside your sleeping bag. There's some interesting things there because you use a pillow on the ground all the time, and you want to use a pillow up there as well. At the same time, you realize you don't need to. So again, there's this psychological argument going inside your own mind where you want to have the comfort of a pillow, and yet you don't need one. But you get over that in a few days. And the sleeping part is not so bad. And the one thing is you're sort of sensory deprived because you're floating inside your sleeping bag. There's no lights because you turn the lights off. And so your whole focus can go on one area. In my case, it was on the music I was listening to as I was going to sleep. And I heard new things in the music that I'd never heard before. Just because your whole senses are focused on the one thing that you're sensing and you're not sensing anything else. So you get a very different perspective on things.
Did you experience any space sickness when you first got into zero-G?
That's a big trade secret for astronauts.
Oh, yeah, okay. Of course not.
Space sickness, yeah, of course not. Now, space sickness is an issue. Something like half the people might have some space sickness symptoms. They could be very mild, and on rare occasions they're worse than mild. But so it's an issue. But sure. We keep it a secret as to who had the problem and who did not.
And tell me about landing, re-entry and landing.
Well, the re-entry is really quite amazing. In fact, we flipped the shuttle over backwards over Australia. And just between Australia and Hawaii, we fired the rockets to slow it down. You re-enter the atmosphere over Hawaii. Excuse me. You still come in at 17,000 miles an hour. And 20, 25 minutes later, you're landing in Florida. And is a very smooth transition. The launch is quite violent in terms of the vibrations you're feeling, but the landing is very, very smooth. You come in sort of belly first into the atmosphere. The pressure you build up on the belly of the shuttle because you're coming into the air is what slows you down. It means you're going so fast, you're not bothered by turbulence in the air or anything like that. So it's a very smooth transition. You build up slowly to a G-load of about 1.8 Gs, which is not very high, and eventually you start flying like an airplane and land. It was all very, very smooth.
And where were you sitting on the orbiter when during launch and landing?
I was in the mid-deck.
In the mid-deck, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Both launch and landing.
Right, okay. Yeah. So you didn't feel any heat on the re-entry or any of that sort of thing?
You actually notice it. The day before, you actually cold soaked the shuttle.
Oh, okay.
So you turn the air conditioning up to the highest and make everything cold.
Oh, internally as well.
Internally, okay. Yeah. You cold soak the radiators and just bring them to the minimum temperature. So as you're building up heat, you're already got a cold soaked shuttle, so it doesn't get quite as much into the shuttle itself.
Right. And after landing, how was the vehicle? Was it looked pretty dinged up?
Yeah, it was a bit dinged up. In fact, there was a in one of the leading the tiles on the nose, there was a little funnel worn all the way down through the tunnel to through the tile. It's about an inch across, about 2 or 3 inches deep.
And that was caused on launch or landing?
That was on landing.
It was landing. Okay.
That's the hot air just eating away at the tile. But you know, maybe we hit a little flake of paint or something up there and caused a little damage, and then the heat would have worn away the rest of it. But you know, the shuttle actually does get worn quite a bit. And if you get a chance to look at the belly of a shuttle, you'll see that there's a lot of scuff marks and dirt marks and things on the tiles. I think it tolerated a certain amount of damage before they replaced them. So that's a bit of an eye-opener, because you think of it as this nice, clean spacecraft. Well, it's a working spacecraft. So there is a little bit of damage here.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with the Space Show. And if you're ever in Australia, please come in and have a chat to us. Thank you, Briyani Trigvasan.
No, it was a great pleasure, and I spent 3 months in Australia years ago and enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, you're welcome anytime.
Okay, thank you.